Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 12 Democratic presidential hopefuls took the stage last night at Otterbein University in Westerville. Most turned their attention to the new frontrunner, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, especially her proposed Medicare for All plan. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg was among the critics.
This is why people here in the Midwest are so frustrated with Washington in general and Capitol Hill in particular. Your signature, Senator, is to have a plan for everything except this. No plan has been laid out to explain how a multi-trillion dollar hole in this Medicare for All plan that Senator Warren is putting forward is supposed to get filled in. And the thing is, we really can deliver health care for every American.
Joining us, Paul Beck, Ohio State University political science professor emeritus. Welcome back.
Good to be here, Ann.
Also, Latrice Washington, an associate professor of political science and history at Otterbein University. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And WOSU reporter Nick Evans covered the debate last night. Welcome.
Yes, I did. Hey.
You were also in Westerville before the debate started last night. What was it like?
Well, you know, it was quiet, quaint for the most part. You know,
Westerville.
I wandered around kind of early in the afternoon and saw a couple of different organizing groups together. There were folks calling for an end to taxes on menstrual products. There were people who were big open carry supporters. PETA was there as well, talking about the impact of food production on climate change. The organizing got bigger in the afternoon later. There was a big march with a bunch of union members. But for the most part, it seemed as though people were getting along fairly well. There was some friction, but it wasn't overwhelming from what I saw.
And Latrice Washington, you teach at Otterbein. You were at the debate. What did you say? Had you ever been to a presidential debate before?
I actually had.
Okay.
And I had a ticket, but I actually had assignments. I had about 10 interviews.
Okay.
So,
working.
Yes, so I was working. It's actually been wonderful to see Otterbein highlighted this way. And it's a nice, serene, quiet kind of campus.
Yeah.
Best of both worlds, suburban. Close enough to the city, and our population is also looking like the United States in terms of international students, greater diversity, not just racial, but also in terms of class. And so it was a wonderful opportunity. I believe 300 of our students actually were able to attend. So it was a wonderful time to see democracy in action.
And Paul Beck, Westerville was chosen because it's sort of a represents kind of the new Democrat, how the demographics are changing across the country. What did you think about that choice?
Well, I thought it was a very good choice. I think it was good for Otterbein.
Yeah.
And Otterbein was a wonderful host for the debates, but also was chosen because it's Ohio, which still, I think, is a swing state and probably will be in 2020. The suburbs are a good locale for the debates, because that is going to be a hotly contested area in the 2020 contest, as will be turnout factors in big cities. And so it's close to Columbus as well. So it was a good choice. And Otterbein, I think, wanted to host it, which is another factor that we don't often talk about. But not a lot of places want to have the hoopla.
The trouble.
Of the meetings.
Yeah, right.
And Ohio State, I know, is that way. The Ohio State's very reluctant to host these kinds of things.
How did you, well? You were in this
spin room. Yeah, they didn't let us into the big kids' room.
Okay,
yeah. I mean it's sort of, you know, a reporter prom. You know, you've got like a big gymnasium, half of it laid out with like a carpet for, you know, the actual spin room stuff at the end, where you have people with the big placards for their candidate, you know, answering questions after the debate itself. And then the other half of it, just a bunch of tables with, mm-hmm. with reporters and laptops, you know, typing out tweets.
How many reporters were there, would you estimate?
I mean, like, so based on the chairs that were listed, uh-huh. they had them all numbered out. I think roughly like 500, maybe
wow.
another 100 plus than
okay.
that. Yeah,
so. I mean, that sounds like the kind of get together you'd see for a national convention,
right?
So this is a big deal. What What was the mood covering these debates in that room?
I mean, honestly, it seemed pretty quiet, mm-hmm. pretty just sort of, you know, typical, exactly what you would expect. I think that the one real big, like, noticeable, like, surprising moment was when Elizabeth Warren and Biden had that back and forth about the CFPB, when she basically said, I'd like to thank Barack Obama for that, standing right next to Joe Biden after he had said that he had helped whip votes for her on the Senate floor for it. The reporters, like, there was a pretty audible gasp at that. But beyond that, it was just, you know, a quiet evening with, you know, a whole bunch of new friends.
It didn't seem that combative to me, Paul Beck.
Well, there were elements
there
that were
moments,
combative.
But I never felt a sense of disrespect or vitriol.
I think only what Nick is saying was something that caught my attention mm-hmm. as well. And it was interesting that Elizabeth Warren pondered before she said that. So I think she was very conscious of what she was doing. Sometimes things just slip out inadvertently. This, I don't think, was an inadvertent slip. There were occasional back and forth. I think Buttigieg and O'Rourke had one over gun control.
Right.
It got
mm-hmm.
pretty sharp, actually. And Buttigieg, again, a bit out of character for him.
Right.
Just like it was out of character, I think, for Warren. A bit out of character, kind of attacked O'Rourke on that. But by and large, you know, these are people who largely agree on broad issues. They have different plans, let's say, for universal health care, but they all believe in universal health care. So, mm-hmm. you know, there is some room for differentiation. And, of course, they want to be able to differentiate themselves from one another because they want to persuade voters they ought to vote for them rather than these other mm-hmm. candidates. But by and large, it was not a contentious evening.
Huh. You know, when we call it a pack, and that becomes obviously clear why, when you have the front runner change like it did, the attention then goes to a largely Elizabeth Warren, former Vice President Joe Biden, much quieter last night. What did you think, Latrice Washington?
I think part of what people have been complaining about is the degree to which they're kind of like going at one another. And we have that many candidates on the stage. And obviously, we're still a distance away from having a Democratic nominee while you have an incumbent president who's running. It's important to make sure that the party doesn't do the work for the incumbent president by being too antagonistic with one another and kind of ripping one another apart. So I think they did a good job at, you know, obviously they're, again, trying to separate themselves from the pack. And in doing so, many of the attacks came more around issue as opposed to just like that one or mm-hmm. maybe one other moment that might have been a little more personal. Mm-hmm. So I think they were a lot more civil this go around. And perhaps they even heard the complaints of people like, this is not a good portrayal of how we want to see leadership. And especially when we're talking often about a president that people often see as lacking civility, you don't want to mimic the same behavior that you're complaining about.
That was abundantly clear. That was the first question out of the box to the candidates was the issue of
impeachment.
The impeachment inquiry.
Right.
And they all kind of, you know, embraced that wholeheartedly. What about the audience? Was there a sense, was there any way to take the temperature of the audience, Nick Evans, from where you sat?
No, we were in a completely different room.
Thought they seemed quieter than during other debates. I didn't get that, but did you, Latrice Washington?
Well, being in the spin room, you could hear there were moments where candidates would say things and, you know, they got their zinger in people would clap. But for the most part, I thought it was pretty peaceful.
Pretty quiet, yeah. Now Ohio you, nice, right?
Yes. Ohio nice. Yeah.
Right. And Westerville nice.
mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a lot of that.
Well, I think they also were told to not respond mm-hmm. visibly.
Well, they always are, I think.
They always are. Sometimes the supporters of the various candidates on the stage are packing the audience. That may have been less true last night. I think there were a lot of people that the Ohio Democratic Party had given tickets to. And, of course, there was a lot of room for students from Otterbein as well. And it's not a huge hall either. Mm-hmm. So when you put those together, you know, maybe you could understand why it was not a crowd that was highly partisan in terms of their visible reactions to things.
And then the there was a lot of concern about having so many candidates on the stage together. It was the largest number so far. Nick Evans, what did you think about the moderating, how the moderators handled it, how it, the flow of it, how it worked? Because there's probably going to be a few fewer and for the next debate, right. But all things being equal, it's still a large field.
I mean, given a sort of an impossible problem, I think they did a pretty decent job, right? I mean, like, if person like Tom Steyer didn't get a ton of time, right? Julian Castro and Cory Booker didn't get a ton of time, but they also did make a point of trying to bring them in. Of course, most of the emphasis was on your main front runners, but all things being equal, I thought that they did a decent job of sort of moving it around and keeping it lively and not getting too bogged down in something that happened in some of the previous debates where it really turned into so-and-so says this, how do you respond? And then do you want to respond to their response? And would you like to respond to their response to your response? There was a little bit of that in terms of like the healthcare debate type thing, and maybe a little bit in guns. But for the most part, I thought that they kept it moving.
What did you think, Latrice Washington? We call these things debates. They're more like forums in a way, right?
Right. I actually thought it was – at this juncture, obviously, the group needs to be
– winnowed.
Yes. Yes. but one thing that we understand is clearly a number of people on the stage – are not really there with the expectation of winning the nomination. They're campaigning for something else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the Democrats were to win, you know, cabinet appointments and other posts. So once you keep that in mind, you understand why you want to stick it out as long as you possibly can. And they have legitimate supporters. So you don't want to let them down either. But I don't know how great, the remaining group will actually do with fundraising after last night.
Well, they said just during the debate, Bernie Sanders raised $600,000. So he's still doing strong. So we got Sanders, we've got Warren, Biden. Who else do you feel like is in that front pack now, Paul Beck?
Well, I think Harris has slipped a bit. And I thought she did not have a strong debate performance, even though in the first debate, I thought she was very, very strong. There's some others that are at the fringes of what eligibility, in a sense, are going to have trouble raising money, are going to have trouble getting above the percent they need to get in the polls. So I think this will have a winnowing effect. And then, of course, there were the candidates who were not on the stage. And my guess is they will be gone.
Tim Ryan of Ohio, Congressman
yes.
from Ohio. Yeah.
Yes.
And did anyone surprise you among the second tier up there?
I thought Buttigieg had a very strong debate, and he's good at that, actually. His answers are always crisp, and he's very good at explaining things on his feet, as is Elizabeth Warren, and we know that about her. But I thought he had a good debate. I thought Amy Klobuchar was maybe not a surprise to me, but I think she got more time. And her answers were more fulsome than they had been in the past. And she clearly is trying to stake out the ground of the moderate or centrist wing of the Democratic Party. And I thought that she did that very effectively. So I would expect her to be able to continue on, whereas she, I think, was probably one of the ones who was least able to qualify for the debates. But we'll see what happens over time.
And in the spin room, we know, Nick Evans, that everybody claims victory in the spin room, right?
Right.
Yeah. Did anyone jump out at you?
In terms of claiming victory for the night, who won
and
the night?
Just who maybe – it's hard to say anyone wins a night when there's 12 people up there from where I sit. But
I mean, I don't know. It seemed as though to me Elizabeth Warren was being treated by the other candidates as the front runner. And that meant she took a lot of fire. I think that she certainly didn't handle all of it perfectly, but she did a reasonable job with it. I think in terms of helping themselves from where they were before they came into the night, I think Buttigieg like did a good decent job of trying to claw into that upper rank rather than being in that middle tier. I don't know if he quite got there, but mm-hmm. you know, the two that you mentioned, Buttigieg and Klobuchar, I think both did a decent job of trying to at least make a solid pitch for here's why you should keep me around.
Buttigieg is interesting. I mean, you know, no one had ever heard of him before,
right.
or most people hadn't heard of him before. They couldn't pronounce his name. They couldn't spell it. I can now pronounce it and spell it. And people know him. I mean, if you think about it, that's kind of an amazing trajectory from South Bend mayor to, you know, being a standout on a presidential debate stage. So anyways, Nick Evans, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Happy to do it.
And we will continue our conversation, breaking it down, this fourth Democratic primary presidential debate. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. During the fourth Democratic presidential primary debate, the 12 candidates who made it to this stage talk about everything from the impeachment inquiry to age to the growing income inequality in the United States. Frontrunner Elizabeth Warren questioned why some of the others didn't support her plan to tax the wealthy.
My question is not why do Bernie and I support a wealth tax. It's why is it does everyone else on this stage think it is more important to protect billionaires than it is to invest in an entire generation of America?
That did get a little bit of an applause. Still with us, OSU political scientist and professor emeritus Paul Beck, and associate professor of political science and history at Otterbein University, Latrice Washington. Wendy Smooth is associate professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and political science at OSU. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
Everyone on the stage called for the impeachment of the president. What do you think listeners learned from that, Wendy Smooth?
That the Democrats have a united front. Obviously, there was lots of agreement on the basis of impeachment, a lot of aggressive calling out of Trump's behavior, which was really quite interesting. Bernie Sanders in particular was really direct in terms of the most corrupt president in our nation's history. And I was really wanting to reach out to my historian colleagues and find out if they had a different read.
What did you think, Paul Beck?
Well, James Buchanan.
Yeah.
Yes.
Quite a race, but
we'll modify it.
Yes. Modern times, I suppose.
Sure. Yeah.
What did you think about that dynamic, though, of raising the impeachment inquiry right off the bat? And, you know, they really pulled out. They sharpened their knives, at least, mm-hmm. on the president.
Well, that obviously is the issue of the moment. There's no question mm-hmm. about that. And it's also an area where they all agree. And in fact, I think that Gabbard was the one who was the slowest to come to an endorsement of the impeachment inquiry. But she was there as well. And I think prompted by probably the Ukraine phone call and maybe even the Syrian mm-hmm. situation.
The pullout.
They all agree on that. They are all candidates to try to defeat Trump, obviously. And I felt that they didn't probably take as much advantage of the podium to try to do that than they could have. One thing I was looking for as they were talking about the taxing of the wealthy is that, that Trump had pledged to give the middle class a big tax break and to increase taxes on the wealthy. Well, that didn't happen.
Right.
He instead really accepted the Republican play card and reduced taxes on the wealthy much more than he did on the middle class. And they could have capitalized on that, but they didn't. And, you know, maybe that will come later on.
I was I guess I was surprised that they didn't talk more to Latrice Washington about how the Trump administration is deconstructing Obamacare and many other things. But in their arguments for Medicare for All or for health, universal health care, whatever it might have been, there's some, you know, there's a target there.
There is a target there. I think they really spent more time dealing with one another on where they differed on that issue. And I do think that was would have been an appropriate place to attempt to heavily hit President Trump. There were some other places where they just kept working in, you know, he's the problem, he's the problem. And in that sense, I was thinking, oh, you might need to be careful. You think about the public opinion polls. Yes, Republicans and Democrats alike disproportionately are saying, okay, we're okay with the inquiry. It breaks down and becomes polarized when we start talking about actual impeachment and removal. Mm-hmm. And then you think back to it's Obama. Obama's the problem. Well, that worked for Trump. The problem becomes if you're constantly saying someone's the problem, you have to demonstrate how you're the solution. And that didn't necessarily resonate with each candidate that kept saying it's Trump, it's Trump. And that negative kind of perspective can work, but we're talking about President Trump. So a lot of things historically we've expected to work are not working when it comes to this particular candidate. And so for me, I thought they pushed impeachment enough. And I thought perhaps they were looking at the numbers and recognizing his base isn't going to move. And if you shove it, you might shove some people in his camp that may be separating or isolating from him.
Mm. Yeah. Wendy Smooth, except for Kamala Harris and her call for more attention to be paid to women's health issues, particularly abortion, there wasn't much of a Me Too moment last night either.
Right. And it was really interesting to see Kamala Harris aggressively move into Amy Klobuchar's lane with reproductive health, because yeah, in previous debates, that's really been Amy Klobuchar's standout moment to bring to the forefront women's health. What I did think was really interesting in that exchange is that when Kamala Harris first brought it up, the moderator completely dropped it. And we did see it came up. It did come up later as a point of question. But in terms of a back and forth engagement, yeah, to allow the candidates to engage Kamala Harris directly, I thought that was a really exceptionally failed moment on the part of the moderator. And in these modern debates, the moderators play as much of a role as the actual candidates on stage. The other piece that I was really interested in kind of listening through in that exchange is Julian Castro's recasting of reproductive health as a matter of reproductive justice, which is really resonating more with women of color because it takes on the broad span of both access to reproductive technologies as well as abortion and extends a conversation on the right to have children no matter the circumstances. And that's a much more broad framing. And it's interesting to see that come into the broader discussion in such a powerful way.
Do you see, Paul Beck, the gender issues coming more to the fore as this progresses or not?
They could. I think we have to think about the 2016 backdrop, where gender issues were important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a feeling on the Democratic side that they were not effective with voters necessarily. And it may well be that, that candidates are not going
elected
to emphasize,
yeah,
those things. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there is the Roe v. Wade question and mm-hmm. what the Supreme Court is going to do and may do before the election, actually. That'll bring those issues right into the forefront if the Supreme Court strikes down Roe v. Wade, which I don't expect them to do, but I think what they will do is narrow its scope and narrow it considerably. It's interesting that while there was focus on Trump, obviously, there were several places where I think the candidates could have found real openings to contrast themselves with Trump. One that I really expected to see, and it never came, was to bring up the Hunter Biden situation, thereby making it salient to people in the audience, you know, watching the debate, but to bring it up in such a way where they were contrasting the behavior of the Trump family with Hunter Biden, where the Trump family, obviously working out of the White House, is you know, making all kinds of or creating all kinds of advantages for themselves business-wise. And why they didn't do that, I don't know. It would have been an opportunity, I think, for the candidates to kind of subtly criticize Biden, but more frontally criticize the president and to create a contrast between, you know, the Biden family or Hunter Biden and the Trump family.
Yeah, Wendy Smith?
I think that's a really interesting point, but I do want to piggyback on the gender issues that were before us last night. I would say there are many different ways to bring up gender issues, and it's not necessarily a direct policy issue. Mm-hmm. I very much saw the impact of representation last night. There were several times where we saw a split screen with two women candidates, Warren and Klobuchar, disagreeing, having a different point of view from each other, destabilizing this notion that women are a monolithic group. Another moment in the evening, we saw a split screen with Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren also disagreeing on a very different point. Those are very salient gender issues for the campaign because we have arrived at a different moment in terms of our understandings of women as political candidates. And I'll have to tell you, I had a big impact moment last night. My six-year-old daughter came through. Don't ask why she was still up that time of night. But she came through and she looked at the television and she said, "Oh, yeah, the next president are on TV." And it was a moment in which Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar were on this split screen. And I went, wow, this is representation that really impacts the future.
It's feeling normal now and not unusual, right, Latrice Washington?
Right. I think that statement that Hillary Clinton made about, you know, kind of cracking the ceiling and realizing she wasn't the one that was going to break through and the women that went before her tried to, like, take a stab at bringing that ceiling down, that it's a lot more attainable for a female candidate to run and one day win the presidency. And more people are becoming aware of not just the leadership ability, but also the double standard we have about how we judge a presidential candidate that is female versus male. You know, be assertive. Oh, she's aggressive. You know, somehow it often takes a negative tone in terms of those attributes that we think a president should have. But somehow, again, that like traditional nurturer, you know, play nice kind of role gets, you know, is the stigma that a female candidate has to worry about the balance of it all. You know, come across strong, but not too strong. Come across nurturing, but not weak.
Such a tightrope.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and it didn't feel like anyone was walking that tightrope last night, really. Paul Beck?
I agree with that. In fact, I'm thinking as I listen to this, which is, I think, right on target, that the difference between Hillary Clinton and the women candidates who were on the stage last night is that Hillary Clinton was there because of her husband. It was her husband who had propelled her into the limelight politically, whereas the women on the stage last night were there independent of any partner, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah. So we have some fun to agree to disagree. You know, we can't dismiss Hillary Clinton's incredible record of political service.
Oh, of course not.
Sure.
Yes.
But name recognition is a thing.
Right. But that was also the saddlebag for her as well.
Absolutely.
In terms of wearing the Clinton name. I thought it was really interesting in the treatment of the candidates, you know, to your point around who's walking the tightrope. Mm-hmm. The ways that the candidates went after Elizabeth Warren as being, you know, she had all of the kinds of front runner behaviors, to your point, Latrice, that we expect of a candidate. Of course, you're defiant. My idea is the only idea. Think about the ways in which Trump shapes a debate. It is only his idea, and all other ideas are garbage, you know, or whatever his very inciting language. The absolutism that Elizabeth Warren takes on, that is front runner status. That's what how you perform as the front runner. But that's a space in which we see a very strong gendering in that her fellow candidates. And I was very surprised at Amy Klobuchar for calling that out and saying that that was somehow, you know, off limits. It's like, no, we're playing politics here.
Yeah, this is what the front big runners time
do.
Yeah.
Right. Mm,
yeah. You know, Elizabeth Warren does something that I don't know if anybody else does it as well as she does, which is smile through it all.
Yes.
I think it's probably something she's developed over time as a gender specific strategy. I don't think she does it consciously anymore, but it does. It is noticeable. I see it all the time.
Well, yeah. I was thinking of the same thing, that she has matured as a candidate.
Uh-huh.
If you go back a couple of years when she was saying many of the same things, I think much of what she said was delivered without a smile. It was perceived, rightly or wrongly, as shrill. She's much smoother now. She's always been exceptionally good at her clarity, her clear statements of things. Now, I think they did criticize her on who was going to pay for Medicare for all.
Rightly so. Absolutely.
It's a missing link in all of that.
Yes.
And I think Bernie Sanders had his moment when he mentioned that he wrote the damn bill. It was a great moment. Another thing that's kind of normalized, too, that we're just not even talking about at all, but I just want to mention it, and that's Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He's gay.
Yes.
I mean, this is a moment that I don't know how. I mean, it's a moment that we're not really spending a lot of time on, and that's the moment.
You know, Cory Booker made a comment about standing on the shoulders of others and how civil rights struggles had created this moment in which you could have an African-American woman, a black man, a gay candidate, and it not be the center of what we're talking about. But I do think on on sexuality, we don't have a lexicon. We don't have a language to effectively talk through that issue. So I think we've sidestepped it. And it's a misfortune that we don't have an adequate language to engage, because these are the moments, these big political moments are the times in which we're able to pull issues forward. They resonate in the workplace, in classrooms, in our churches and synagogues. And I think it's a real missed opportunity if we aren't talking about how his lived experience informs his politics.
We'll continue our conversation. That is Wendy Smooth. She's an associate professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and political science at Ohio State. Also with us, Paul Beck, a political scientist and professor emeritus at Ohio State, and Latrice Washington, associate professor of political science and history at Otterbein, where the debate occurred last night among, if you want to call it a debate, the forum, whatever you want to call it, among the 12 of the Democratic presidential primary hopefuls. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the fourth Democratic debate that happened last night at Otterbein University. Still with us, Associate Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies and Political Science at Ohio State, Wendy Smooth. Also from Ohio State, Political Science Professor Emeritus Paul Beck, and Associate Professor of Political Science and History at Otterbein, Latrice Washington. If you have a question or comment, join the conversation. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There was another kind of player on the stage last night, and that was the state of Ohio. Mayor Buttigieg, you know, referenced the Midwest and the role it's probably going to play. Although what really counts is the electoral votes in the final analysis. But Wendy Smooth, what was that? You know, you couldn't see Ohio, but it was everywhere.
Oh, Ohio was such a big player in the conversation last night. I was somewhat giddy about it watching. But, you know, everything from the opioid crisis to talking about the United Auto Workers in Cincinnati and in Loudoun County, it was really a kind of assertion on the part of Democrats that they are coming to take back Ohio. And it will be interesting to see how that conversation continues to play. And I really think it puts Ohio back in that center stage, that we really are a kind of microcosm of every issue plaguing the U.S. in this moment, from the opioid crisis being linked to adequate health care and access to health care, to what is happening with unions, to what is happening with American workers. It was just amazing to see Ohio so strongly back in the spotlight, particularly thinking about what happened in 2016 and how we were sitting here going, are we still relevant?
And I think the next debate is also going to be, correct me if I'm wrong, but is also going to be somewhere in the Midwest. I can't remember. It seems like there's a
is
focus.
Is it Michigan? That
Michigan, yes.
Is hosting the next
That's
one?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. You know, it's and like I said, famously, Pete Buttigieg referred to us in the Midwest, you know, making that point.
Well, of course, several of the candidates on that stage are Midwesterners, or like Biden, are making a play for Midwestern voters. And the outcome in 2016 really turned on what happened in the Midwest.
Sure.
It was the Electoral College victories of Trump in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, and Michigan that won him the presidency. And those were, 77,000 votes in total. Mm-hmm. So the Midwest is clearly in play. The more coastal candidates, I think of Warren, for example, even Sanders, perhaps, Harris from California, are not playing up the Midwest as much as the others are. And that's another one of the, another one of the ways that candidates are trying to distinguish themselves.
Let's hear, you know, Senator Warren explained her idea for accountability capitalism at one point during the debate, you know, going to that issue of jobs and what an issue it is in the Midwest. Let's listen.
40% of your board of directors should be elected by your employees. That'll make a difference when a corporation decides, gee, we could save a nickel by moving a job to Mexico, when there are people on the board in the boardroom saying no.
She got very explicit about some things that Americans have not been interested in dealing with, and that is, you know, the makeup of a boardroom. For example, obviously her tax on people worth more than $50 million, which seems so astronomical to a lot of us. She gets very specific about everything but what the tax is going to be on the middle class for health care. What do you think, Latrice Washington?
Well, she doesn't know. You know, I think part of what we have to keep in mind is oftentimes they will be extremely specific about things that they in part believe they can accomplish. But politics is the art of negotiation. So when we think about it and you think about all the moving pieces, all the players, a lot of these campaign promises, people should be a little more careful in what they say.
Because I think Klobuchar made that point.
It comes back and it's like you promised and you didn't deliver. And it's a tenuous tenuous place to be. And, for example, you think about DeWine, you know, after everything mm-hmm. in Dayton. And what's been proposed is far from that. And what likely will be put in place will likely be further from that mm-hmm. by the time they get through the entire process of creating this policy. So I think voters have to be very mindful of that. I don't know that it's always strategic. You know, obviously they're very intentional, mm-hmm. but they have to be very careful about being specific about things that they know they can't quite deliver on. That's something specific enough, but also general enough that maybe she may be able to accomplish.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Listen, the thing that just drives me crazy is when people ask them, you know, well, how much is this going to cost? The taxes are going to go up. But the correct answer is that nobody gets free insurance. Nobody. If you work for an employer and you have a great health plan and you don't have to pay anything, your employer is paying for it. So there's no such thing as free health insurance. All they have to do is say, look, we're going to take the same amount of dollars and we're going to be much more efficient with the dollars. I don't understand why people think that 168 million people are getting that health care for free if they're working for somebody. It's not free. It's mm-hmm. costing somebody something. We have to just admit it and use those dollars to the best way we can use them. Mm-hmm.
We, you know, what about health care? Do you think it's going to be the issue again at the forefront?
I think we will sit in this moment around health care. And it's really interesting. Earlier, we were talking about the ways in which Obamacare shows up and doesn't show up. We're in a very radically different moment. I'm very shocked that we have moved so far in such a short period of time for calling for a single health payer model in 2016 and a little earlier than that, that was unfathomable.
Totally and now it's radical.
I remember a graduate course and my student is listening and will say, yeah, I told you so. But I like laughed in mockery, like we would not get there. And here we are. And I stand duly corrected on that point. But it just did not seem like a plausible even conversation. And to the caller's point, I do think we as the American people do have to be honest about what is required of us in terms of any public policy and who is paying in to it. It's a much more solid discussion when we are all owning that someone's contributing and some payment has to happen. This is a transactional component, which would likely move us more to the cost of health care, right? And the cost of prescription drugs in a much more productive way than where we've landed so far.
Like, just tell me how much it's going to cost. And
let's be transparent about the cost.
It is going to cost.
Right. And let's, let's issue fair play for consumers in regards to the cost of health care.
Well, here's a case where the contrast between Warren and Sanders is sharp, actually, that both of them are for Medicare for all. Sanders has said, and I think quite honestly, that, well, in the end, you will save money because even though taxes will go up to pay for it, your premiums will disappear. Your co-pays will disappear. Where that ends up, who knows? The point that's, I think, important to bear in mind is that health care is, what, 20% of the economy?
And we still have the insurance business involved.
And it's a very complicated thing. But to Wendy's point, I just want to mention that Obamacare, I think, had two accomplishments. One is that it provided health care for people who didn't have it before. And there were some other things that were kind of bundled with that. But even more importantly, perhaps, and this really is to Wendy's point, is that it convinced Americans that universal health care mm-hmm. was a right, not a privilege. Mm-hmm. And even the Republicans have been dragged kind of kicking and screaming into that. Now, they don't really want to be there, I don't think. But they've recognized that if by their reforms, quote, end quote, they end up making people worse off in terms of their health care, mm-hmm. particularly with pre-existing conditions, they're going to lose votes.
Sure.
And so that's an accomplishment, and it's something that 10 years ago we wouldn't have imagined would occur.
Right. Now there's a takeaway.
Yes.
They can take something away.
Yes.
if they moved forward with whatever President Trump was talking
Absolutely.
About.
Mm-hmm.
This is another issue. Mike in Westerville, welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My point was that they talked a little bit about the environment, but I think if their people, their handlers, researchers, would have done some research on what's going on in Lake Erie over around Toledo and Sandusky in that area, we are already being affected by global warming and also phosphorus and things like that in the lake. And the condition of the western part of Lake Erie has deteriorated a lot, and it hurts the economy up there.
I'm doing a show tomorrow about how two-thirds of the birds in this country could be extinct by 2100 because if the temperature goes up by just 5 degrees. Mike in Westerville, thanks for that call. What about the environment? Is what's not working that it doesn't make it to the top of the heap? It's the biggest existential threat, I guess that's kind of redundant, that we face.
I think the issue becomes it's a very complex issue. And I actually went in originally before impeachment became an issue. I thought that would have been another issue that was brought. So I kind of walked away
room?
Thinking maybe it kind of got booted out because now we have to speak to impeachment. But I thought more attempts would have taken place of trying to get
And I think he
in.
Makes a salient point mm-hmm. as far as we've got an example of a huge problem right here in the western basin of Lake Erie.
Well, not only here, everywhere.
Right.
And I think that there are probably three issues that will be the major contrast in the fall campaign, aside from Trump's behavior in office and the criticisms of that. But one is climate change, where we really have regressed rather than gone forward. And that debate will be had. The second one is foreign policy, which has now become, mm-hmm. I think, a big issue mm-hmm. for 2020 in a way that I really hadn't predicted
right.
that it would
yeah.
be.
Who knew?
Before Syria and,
Who knew 2 weeks
and,
ago?
And Ukraine. That's right. And then, of course, health care that mm-hmm. we've talked about. That'll be a big issue as well in 2020.
The field's going to narrow. Any predictions about who's not going to be there next time?
I'll try that.
Okay.
I think the one of the 12 on the stage who I thought did poorly last night was Gabbard.
Mm-hmm. From Hawaii, yeah.
From Hawaii.
Tulsi Gabbard.
And I think she's going to have trouble going forward. I also felt that Kamala Harris, who had done well before, didn't do as well. And the reason was that she seemed to be off key
yeah.
in her answers, often not answering the question, sometimes moving into an area that I think was primed for discussion. There's no question about that, but kind of disconnected. Cory Booker, I think, didn't start out particularly well, but came on stronger near the end, but he's had trouble raising money, and so it's going to be a real—
It was predicted he was going to maybe drop out last week.
That's right. Tom Steyer, I thought, really needed to be able to establish himself as a presidential contender. I don't think he did that last night. Now, he's got plenty of money, mm-hmm. so I think that's not going to be a problem. But whether he will be able to achieve the next goals in the polls will be another question. So there are those. I think the four who were maybe six who were off stage, didn't get into the debates, mm-hmm. are probably going to be gone right. fairly right. shortly. Right. Mm-hmm. Others are going to try to hang on until Iowa with the hope that on the ground in Iowa they can establish a strong campaign. We will see. What they were saying last night, and I have no independent knowledge of this, is that Buttigieg seems to be establishing a very good ground game in mm-hmm. Iowa, and that's been fairly new. Klobuchar has strength in Iowa. Mm-hmm. Warren has some strength in Iowa. We'll see how that develops over time.
Yeah. What I would. Oh, okay, sorry. What I
thought especially about Kamala Harris, because I did expect her to try to come back and rally and you know, really fight for this nomination, is it's a classic example of declaring too early.
Huh.
And really exposing a lot about where you sit and kind of being seen as the person who may
too
be
much
the
exposure.
Too much exposure, overexposure, peaking too soon. It's a long race, and you have to have the stamina for it, and deep pockets as well. Mm. So her performance, I don't know that her fundraising is going to improve dramatically from her performance last night.
Latrice Washington, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Latrice Washington, Associate Professor of Political Science and History at Otterbein University. Also, Paul Beck, Professor Emeritus, Political Scientist at Ohio State. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Wendy Smooth, Associate Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies and Political Science at Ohio State.
Thanks, Ann.
Appreciate it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.